crazy.
Ladies and gentlemen, it is a distinct pleasure to be here with you this morning on our 62nd off-site court. We are grateful to Judge Rocky Koss for giving up his courtroom and his chambers for our use today. We are very pleased with the number of students that are participating in our program. We look forward to the arguments and I think that even more exciting, especially for the lawyers, will be the debriefing sessions that you'll be doing with the students. So we will begin with our first case, 10-1636, State of Ohio versus Tanisha Gunnell. And for the appellant is Andrew Pisak. It's Pisak, isn't it? I'm sorry.
Yes.
Madam Chief Justice, may it please the court, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. The trial court in this case, in response to the juror misconduct, exercised sound discretion in finding that there was a manifest necessity for a mistrial. This is one of those cases where the public interest in a fair trial outweighed the defendant's interest in having his case heard before a particular jury. The Second District, though, did not defer to the trial court's discretion in this case. It disagreed with the trial court's decision and imposed its own idea of how the situation should have been handled, the questions the trial court should have asked of the juror that committed the misconduct, and did not have the benefit of actually being in the courtroom when this occurred. Essentially, the Second District grafted onto the abuse of discretion standard a new standard that the trial judge have to ask specific questions, and they've basically created its per se abuse of discretion if you don't follow this procedure. In this case, the particular questions the Second District complains of that were not asked regarding whether the juror could be fair and impartial and some other questions would have been a frivolous endeavor on the part of the court to ask those questions. The nature of this juror's misconduct is what made her testimony suspect. What she had done, it didn't really matter what her answer was to those questions. The trial court could not believe what she said, or that she could be fair and impartial anymore.
Well, in this instance, the juror in question brought in an internet depiction or description of part of the court's jury instructions. Is that right? Brought it into the deliberating room?
No, that's the juror brought in a printout from the internet of another instruction she had found regarding involuntary manslaughter.
But that wasn't what the trial court had instructed in the case. Is that right?
Correct. The trial court.
Were there written instructions sent to the jurors prior to that recess when she brought something else in?
Yes, the written instructions would have been given to the jury at the beginning of deliberations, and I believe they were actually in the jury room when the jurors returned for deliberations the next day.
Had the trial court instructed the jurors not to to only consider what he or she had provided?
Yeah, in the instructions that the court gave. I believe it's stated, the court stated several times, you are only to consider the law given you in the courtroom here today. You cannot change the law or apply your own law. Your duty is to apply the instructions of law that I give you. I think also, and voir dire said, limit the information you take in with respect to this case to what is presented to you in the courtroom.
And if I understand your argument, you think this is juror misconduct.
Correct.
And is it your view that the trial court has discretion to determine whether or not a mistrial should or should not be granted under these circumstances?
Yes, I think the trial court's discretion, whether or not there should be a mistrial granted, I think the case law of this court is very clear that that's a matter left to the sound discretion of the trial court, and the Court of Appeals are advised to give great deference to the trial court's handling.
And the test is manifest necessity. And you
correct.
Agree with that?
That's correct.
Then what is the law, or the new law, that comes out of this case? Why isn't this just us correcting a mistake that's made by an appellate court in misinterpreting the law? Seems as though you're telling us this is just perfect, except the Court of Appeals got it wrong, and you should correct their mistake.
I think, you know, essentially our first proposition of law is along those lines. However, we believe that the Second District has really changed the law with their ruling. They have created a situation where if a trial judge does not ask specific questions, does not ask the juror, can you be fair and impartial, that is a per se abuse of discretion, because this judge didn't ask that question, that now before a judge can grant a mistrial, certain steps must be taken according to the Court of Appeals decision, and we would ask this.
But you're really asking us to rewrite the law that we've already written. It's been written by this court for a period of time, and it's pretty well understood.
I'm sorry. Can you repeat the question, please?
I'm sorry?
Can you repeat the question, please?
Yeah. Are you just asking us to rewrite the law that has already been written by the Supreme Court?
I guess in a manner of speaking, yes. We want this court to uphold the law that already exists in the state of Ohio as far as our first proposition of law and the abuse of discretion, and that this should be left to the trial court's discretion.
Well, counsel, are there a list of questions such as, you know, when there's a Rule 11 colloquy that the judge must ask of the defendant when they're pleading? Is there any list of questions that have been addressed by the courts in that type of a scenario?
No, the courts, the Ohio Supreme Court, this court, and other courts have never required a specific set of questions. There's certain matters that the court is to look into, whether the jury can or the juror is still fair and impartial, whether there are other alternatives to a mistrial. But this court has never required a trial court to ask specific questions in determining whether a mistrial should be declared.
There's areas of inquiry, but there's no rote questions that a judge has to ask of a juror before a mistrial is declared, or the determination that the juror is no longer fit to serve as a juror.
That's correct.
Now, in this case, my understanding is that the judge actually commented on this and saying that this juror, by virtue of the fact she went out and did research on her own, didn't listen to what the judge said, you know, came back into the jury room, that she was irreparably tainted. So in the judge's mind, it would not have mattered what she said to him after that point if she couldn't follow the very basic instructions that he gave and honor those. I think the judge used the word irreparably tainted. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. And that's, I guess, kind of our second proposition of law kind of goes along those lines, where we're asking this court to have a rule where if there's juror misconduct such that they have exposed themselves to extrajudicial material, some facts outside what was presented in court, a destruction of law, and that is contrary to what's been presented in the case in some way, that should create some kind of presumption of prejudice. And then the burden would shift to the other party to have to rebut.
Except, counsel, that is you are asking us to make new law in that regard, because in your second proposition, you would be requiring the trial court to determine whether the outside information was prejudicial to the state. And if the judge, as in this case, the judge obviously believed it was, with very little inquiry from the juror, then you would shift the burden to the defense, which does change the law of the state.
That is correct. Yeah, that's what we would be asking in the second propositional law. I do believe this court could dispose of this matter on the first propositional law solely if it so choose to rule in the state's favor and grant that.
Counsel,
this case,
go ahead.
This case does have broad implications, though, if we are considering the fact that jurors now have the potential of looking on the Internet and potentially going far afield from what the judge has stated they should do. Is that one of the reasons that we should be deciding this case?
Yeah, that's correct. I think there have been a lot of recent instances throughout the country where we have seen juror misconduct of this form, where they are going on the Internet to do legal research, or even, you know, an example is look up the criminal history of the defendant, which likely was not used at all in trial. You know, something that would probably be very prejudicial to a defendant. Jurors in Warren County that conducted their own experiments when they went home for deliberation. There's a lot of situations where we're looking at juror misconduct.
Was there particular instruction given to the jurors regarding Internet research? Do you know?
No, there was no particular instruction that specific to the jury. They were generally instructed to limit what they hear about the case to what they hear in the courtroom and to decide the case and the law as given to them by the judge.
Counsel, tell me if I'm mistaken about this. isn't the thrust of what the Court of Appeals is saying is that the judge has to undertake a reasonable effort to see if the juror can be rehabilitated, rather than saying there are per se absolute questions that have to be asked?
I don't know that that's really what the Court of Appeals is saying in this case. It seems to me that the
Well, don't you want to flip it around and say the judge can look at misconduct and say it's per se a mistrial without much further inquiry?
I think some inquiry is required, and the court did engage in that here to find out what the juror had done, what research she had done. You know, some minimal questioning was done of the juror.
And what she had done with it.
Correct.
Right. Whether she had exposed the rest of the panel to it.
Right. And in this case, because the bailiff was able to catch the juror with the items in her hand, she was not able to share it with the other jurors. But obviously at this point in time at this trial, they did not have the benefit of being able to substitute any alternate jurors. That was not an option that very easily could have avoided a mistrial in this case were that available.
And why wasn't that?
In 2008, the rules were amended to permit alternate jurors to be retained during deliberations in non-capital cases. So
counsel, as I read the Court of Appeals decision, it seemed as if the state initially was not going to move for a mistrial, and it was only after some significant push by the trial judge and suggesting to the state that this might be prejudicial to the state, given what the judge interpreted the research could mean, that the state then, after several prompts by the trial court judge, asked for a break, went out in the hallway or wherever to talk for 5 or 10 minutes, and then came back and requested a mistrial. Is that accurate?
I don't believe that the Court of Appeals' perception of that, how that went, is accurate. I didn't have the benefit of being present, and there's obviously a lot of discussions, and what's in the mind of the prosecutor is not in the record. But my understanding from discussions with attorneys that were present is that during that, is actually I think the actual break was around 20 minutes. The court, we had asked for a five-minute break. All of the prosecutors were brought in. There was a discussion about what should we do here, you know, what is the right course of action. And at that point in time, the prosecuting attorney, Steve Shoemaker, decided that a mistrial, that he should move for a mistrial, and that would be the appropriate choice in this case to ensure a fair trial. If there are no further questions, I will reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Counsel, yes. I do have one in that case. You're making it sound like the Second District is asking for something beyond what the general rule is. But isn't the general rule, once you discover what actually happened, is then to ask the next question or go into that area as what impact that would have on the juror and whether she could, in this case, disregard that information? That is going to whether or not there is prejudice that can't be overcome. That's not really an unusual thing, is it?
Yeah, the additional questions could have been asked, but I don't think it's an abuse of discretion that they were not asked. The fact that the juror went at home, did this research in the middle of deliberations, and brought the materials with her to the courtroom, and then told the court, well, I was only going to share the one written definition, and I wasn't going to share the involuntary manslaughter definition, but still brought it with her into the jury room. I think that information was enough for the judge to conclude that this juror was irreparably tainted and that he could not trust her to continue in deliberations in this case.
Counsel, none of the other jurors were examined. Is that correct?
That's correct.
The judge did not bring the panel in and just ask if there had been any communications between the one juror and the rest.
Correct. Only the juror at issue, juror number 6, was asked if she had shared the information. She said no. I mean, based on the information that the bailiff gave to the court, where this was the second juror to arrive that morning to restart deliberations, and she obtained the papers from her immediately.
Before a mistrial, though, isn't it usual for the court to take that step, not just to question the potential juror who might have committed misconduct, but the impact on the rest of the jurors?
I think it depends upon the circumstances of the case. Here, because there was no indication that the other jurors had been exposed to this material at all, there was no need to ask them any questions. No information would have been gained from that, and I think it was appropriate for the trial court to assume that they did not get any information from the other juror.
And there was no alternate available to substitute for this juror?
Correct, because deliberations had started the day before. All the alternates had been dismissed previously.
Mr. Pasek, would we be here if the juror had just looked up a word in the dictionary that the juror didn't understand?
It would depend if we knew about it, I suppose. The definition in this case that the juror brought with her of perverse, I'm not sure that's really the correct definition, but that was a problem that likely could have been corrected with the judge giving a definition out of the dictionary once it was discovered that
we're
the juror
really
found
here because the juror went beyond and got into the definition or a definition of involuntary manslaughter.
Correct.
Do we concern ourselves with the other activity in looking up a definition of a word that someone didn't understand?
I think it's relevant to show the character of the juror and what the trial court had in its mind when it was determining the credibility of this juror and whether she would be trusted to follow the court's instructions of law in the future if she were to continue.
So is your point more then that this is a juror who was contemptuous of the court in refusing or failing to follow the court instructions, as opposed to a different jury instruction?
Yeah, I mean, she failed to follow the court's instruction, conducted outside research, and because of that, with the misconduct that she had done.
Was there any determination by the court that what the juror had learned from the internet couldn't be extricated from her mind to orient her back to what the court had instructed, because that was already planted there from what she had learned independently?
I believe the court was able to and did infer that from the facts of the case regarding what the juror did, that she brought the items with her into the jury room, and based on her answers to his questions, that was inferred. The question was never directly asked of the juror.
Is there any determination that what the juror received from the internet was aligned with or contrary to the law in Ohio?
Yes, the definition that she brought with her was an involuntary manslaughter definition that referred to recklessness, which is not part of involuntary manslaughter in Ohio, also referred to the person having several drinks, basically a drunk driver, killing someone. And the concern was the jury had recklessness before them in terms of aggravated robbery and felony murder. They also had an involuntary manslaughter count before them, and the definition gave a high likelihood that the juror...
Culpable mental state of the defendant was confused with respect to the two counts, is what you're saying.
Correct.
Thank you.
Counsel, was the word... was there a jury question to ask for a definition of perverse?
Yeah, the jury did ask the night before, shortly before they were dismissed, for a definition of the word perverse.
And it wasn't given them. There wasn't a response to it, correct?
That's correct. No response was given. The trial judge's reasoning was there was no definition available in the law of Ohio, and so he did not give a definition.
Okay, so it is understandable if someone doesn't understand what a word means that they're going to go look it up.
Understandable, but if they were to obey their oath and follow the rule that they are not to expose themselves to any outside information, they should not have done that.
But if the judge wasn't going to answer a question, like, Judge, I don't know what this word means.
I guess I don't know. I know we have from the transcript, there's some additional discussion with the jurors after the fact, where they indicated that at least one of them was pushing to ask additional questions of the court, but that stage was never, they never got to that stage in the deliberations.
All right. Thank you.
If there are no further questions, I'll reserve whatever I have left for rebuttal. Thank you.
Mr. Griffin.
Good morning, Madam Chief Justice, Justices, Mr. Pasek, students. I'm James Griffin. I was with Tanisha at the first trial. I was with her at the second trial. I was with her at the third trial. And if this court decides to change the law like the appellant is asking, I will be with her at the fourth trial. If this court does not change the law like the appellant is asking, then it must affirm the Second District Court of Appeals, and this case should not have been even accepted by this court.
And if we affirm the Court of Appeals, what's the outcome for your client?
My client will walk with no criminal record, which is not fair.
And the other defendants involved?
The other defendants, one is pending an appeal, which has been stayed pending the decision in this case. The other two have entered new pleas of guilty to reduced offenses while this matter was pending. So two of them are incarcerated right now. The other, both my client and the other case that's on appeal to this court, are they're also incarcerated with no bond. But we're only asking that this court apply State versus Lange and the tests that were provided in that case. The trial judge in this case did not do that. He presumed and pushed the prosecutor, pushed the appellant to ask for a mistrial. At first, and it's on page 34 of that day's transcript, Mr. Shoemaker said, "We believe that this juror made a mistake. It's a grievous mistake, but with a firm instruction, she can be corrected and the deliberations can go on." There was no inquiry as to the tests that are put forth in State versus Lange. There was no looking into the circumstances. There was no impact on the juror that was decided by the trial court. The trial court simply said, "We presume that she's going to be prejudiced. This is so bad."
But doesn't a trial judge have the right to make that call? Because the trial judge can look at the juror, evaluate the answer, evaluate the misconduct, and if the judge has determined there's no way this juror can be rehabilitated, isn't that a trial judge's discretion to make that decision?
I do not believe so, no. Not without some inquiry, as was set forth starting back in Rimmer and Phillips and then most recently in Lange. I think some inquiry must be made, if nothing else, to preserve the record.
So the trial judge is supposed to do some sort of magic words like, "Are you prejudiced?" Is the judge, that's what the trial judge is supposed to ask?
The judge could have asked a few more questions or asked the state. And the thing that worries me most about what the state is projecting here today is that if you take the contrary argument to their second proposition of law, it would read that when extrajudicial material contrary to the defendant's case through juror misconduct is obtained, the situation is presumptively prejudicial, and the burden then falls on the state to prove that that was not prejudicial. In almost any contact with a juror during deliberations, incidental or not, is going to raise, if the court adopts this rule, is going to raise a presumption of prejudice, either for the state or against the defendant.
What do you believe the current rule is?
The current rule is that the court must inquire of the juror and should inquire of the remaining jurors what the effect of the, what happened, what the effect of it was on the all of the jurors, and whether or not both parties can still get a fair trial.
And is there a presumption either way in the current rule?
The presumption is that the party against whom it is shown to be prejudiced bears the burden of proving that that prejudice does exist, that it prejudiced their case. The state is asking that the court reverse that burden of proof and throw it to the other side. And that's what should not happen by this court. Most often it's going to fall on the defendant to prove that there was prejudice.
Mr. Griffin, why were the alternates excused before a verdict had been returned in the case?
Because at that time the rules did not provide for alternates to be sequestered and not to be used during the trial, the deliberations.
Well, because they had been excused, if the court determined that this juror could not extricate from her mind the erroneous internet instruction, and the court determined she had to be excused, there would not be 12 members on the panel, and wouldn't mistrial be appropriate under those circumstances?
Yes.
And isn't that what the court did?
No. The court didn't go through what I believe State versus Lange requires of a juror. He said, she's a nice lady. She's telling me what she thinks the truth is. She says she can set it aside. She says she's sorry for doing this. She hasn't shown it to the other jurors, but I don't believe her.
Well, why isn't it the judge's prerogative not to believe her?
Because everybody else in the courtroom had said that they did believe her, and if you go through the Court of Appeals opinion, when we came back for the third trial, we had a similar circumstance happen. And at that point, the judge brought every juror in, questioned every juror, went through an exhaustive.
But that was a different situation than what we have here with this one juror. But getting back to the problem that we have before us, the judge actually, she said she could not pay attention to the information Correct. That she secured and not share it. She said she could do that.
Correct.
All right. Well, isn't that what you're asking that a judge do, is ask, you know, Mrs. So-and-so, are you able to forget what you learned on the Internet and sit on this case?
Yes.
All right. And depending on what her answer is, it is up to the judge to determine whether that is a truthful answer or one that can be relied upon. Is that not true? He doesn't tally or take a, you know, of all the people sitting here, how many people think she can do it and how many people think she can't, and then that's going to be determinative. It's for the judge to determine, and only the judge. Is that correct?
In most cases, yes.
When wouldn't it be up to the judge to determine that?
When there is nobody else in the courtroom who's asking for a mistrial, when nobody else is thinking that this juror is not telling the truth.
Counsel, right. Was...
But, well, I guess maybe if you look at the overall duty and responsibility of the court to manage the trial, the judge to be in charge of the trial, it's not a judge overstepping their bounds in order to make a determination that the juror is tainted.
When the trial judge makes that decision outside of the bounds of...
You're saying because the defense attorney didn't ask for this, the state's attorney didn't ask for this, that the judge could not take what is the equivalent of judicial notice that this is a tainted juror?
I don't think that he was making that finding. I think he was saying that what she had looked up was so prejudicial to the state that it could not be overcome.
And I guess you're by inference saying that if she had come in, for example, and I'm just using this as a hypothetical, that the defendant's record, which was not in evidence but was then brought in through an Internet search or something, was brought in, you're saying that if the defense hadn't made a request for or wouldn't make a request for a mistrial, the judge couldn't sua sponte say this is tainted?
I don't believe that would be reversible error. No, I don't.
Counsel, was this juror asked whether she had understood the instructions that she was not supposed to do what she did, or was she merely asked what it was that she did?
I believe she was merely asked what she had done. And the jury had asked the 11 o'clock or 12 o'clock at night for the definition of perverse, and there was no response to that. So what she did was, I think, the natural human thing to do.
Mr. Griffin, I'm trying to understand when you talk about inherently prejudicial, that the judge said this was inherently prejudicial. Are you saying that there should be nothing considered inherently prejudicial, and that any time we have a situation like this, before declaring a mistrial, the judge must at least inquire in the manner that you've described?
Yes.
All right. Because otherwise, we're talking about a very basically the third trial here. Yes. For your client.
Right.
Counsel, did the judge make any effort at all to take the charge that he had given to the jury, go to the area that she had brought the definitions for, and point out to her that the internet covers the world, and this definition you've brought us, you know, I've given you the Ohio law, and even maybe point out to her the differences and how she would be so mixed up if she were following
that. He did not.
And the perverse is a definition I think none of us have ever seen that she secured, where the judge, with little effort, kept them there till midnight, with little effort could have gone to the dictionary and said, you know, if you folks are struggling with this, here it is. Here's the dictionary definition of perverse.
When the jury came back with the question, the five or six trial counsel, several from the appellant, the three from the four from the defense, went scurrying and looking for OJI and Ohio bar and jury instructions and everything, and we could not find anything very quickly, and it had been a long day, and they just did not give anything to the jury at that point.
Did you agree with that? The defense attorney and the prosecutor agreed that the judge shouldn't respond to that request for a definition.
It was my understanding that we were going to come back the next day and try to work on that. We did not start the next day until 10 o'clock.
So it wasn't declined. The juror was not informed that we're not going to define that for you.
I don't believe so, no.
But they weren't told you're going to get a definition.
No, they were
in
not
the
told that they would get it the next day.
Well, that seems to be, mm-hmm. if we were to suppose anything, it is sending 12 people home at night groping for what does the word perverse mean, and it shouldn't be a surprise to anybody that they'd go home and pull down a dictionary at least and look it up if they're, so it would seem like everybody failed in that regard, or at least not telling them, we'll give you a formal definition in the morning, don't worry about it tonight. Yeah. That didn't happen.
I'm urging this court to affirm the second district, asking this court not to change the law and shift the burden to the party opposing the motion for mistrial. That's going to come back to haunt appellate courts and this court multiple times in the future if that becomes the law of this state. Thank you.
Counsel, you've used all of your time. You may take 30 seconds for a summation.
Thank you, Your Honor. I just wanted to state that the Second District's law is allowed to stand in this case. It's going to dissuade trial courts from granting mistrials, because if they grant a mistrial and they are found to have used their discretion, retrial is barred. If they don't grant the mistrial and let the unfair jury continue to a verdict, we either end up with an acquittal with an unfair jury and the case is done, or we end up here with the defendant complaining that there should have been a mistrial granted when there
wasn't.
So
that's basically our test, is an abuse of discretion here?
Correct. That is the standard that this court has put down, this court put down in Lange, and Lange gave a great deference to the trial court's manner and method of investigating the misconduct as well.
What is your response to Mr. Griffin's argument that we should not shift the burden to the party not asking for the mistrial? How do you respond to his position? He says this is going to create havoc all over Ohio.
I think that the burden should shift. I don't think it will create havoc.
I can't hear you.
I'm sorry. I don't think it will create havoc throughout the courts of Ohio. One of the things this court pointed out in its decision in Lange is that It was relevant to this court that the defense counsel did not inquire further when given the opportunity to do so. I think that was an important consideration for this court in that case.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We will take the matter under advisement, and you will be notified of our decision. Thank you very much, gentlemen.